Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
The new documentary, Walkable USA, Proof of Concept, was 4 years in the making. It tells the story of the revitalization of downtown Hammond. The film promotes the idea that walking, the simplest act of transportation, can transform a city. The hour-long movie premiered on Lakeshore PBS in December of 2023. The new documentary will be shown at a public screening on April the 4th at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond. Tom Desch is a director, producer, and writer of several documentaries. Most notably here in the region is the award-winning and Emmy-nominated documentary Shifting Sands about the Indiana Dunes. Tom joins us now to give us a peek of the film. Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, Tom, your new documentary, Walkable USA, has received rave reviews. There was a public screening hosted by Lakeshore Public Media, followed by it being premiered on Lakeshore PBS back in December of 2023. And the film has been embraced by so many, including community members, investors, and stakeholders. So much so that there will be another public screening of the film on April 3rd at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond. Take a moment to give our listening audience a brief synopsis of this film.
So the film really highlights the efforts of the people of Hammond, Indiana, to kind of remake their downtown into a much more pedestrian-friendly environment, you know, really redevelop the downtown with an emphasis on a person walking as opposed to the automobile. And it highlights the work of city planner Jeff Speck, who Hammond hired in conjunction with several others to help create a master plan for Hammond that they're now moving forward with at the moment.
Right. So, Tom, so as you've shared, the documentary Walkable USA is about the collaboration between the city of Hammond and Jeff Speck, again, who is a city planner based in Boston and a walkable city advocate to revitalize the downtown area. In the film, Jeff Speck shares this. How do you get people the choice to walk? The walk has to be a good drive. So, Tom, what is the general theory of walkability?
Well, great. And Jeff, you know, really does a very good job at this. And he kind of broke down, you know, just the idea of what makes a walk enjoyable. He's gonna yell at me for not knocking these off just 1, 2, 3, 4. But really, it needs to be useful. Like, that's a huge thing when we're dealing with walking, is so often, you know, if you're going to make the decision to walk, well, why do you need to walk? So it needs to be useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. And I think I'm covering those correctly. And, you know, and the big thing is that it has to be all of them. It can't just be several. You know, I think it's a very easy way to just look at our communities, and it kind of helps you look at our communities in a different way, you know, when you start viewing your community through the lens of walking.
Thomas Park, for just a moment, because as I shared in my opening, you are an award-winning and Emmy-nominated documentarian, and so I'm interested to know, what made you focus on this particular topic? What made you focus on walkability?
You know, I've always been fascinated with the kind of our surrounding environment, both the built environment and the natural environment. But for some reason, I've always kind of been drawn to either urban areas or small towns. I kind of found that there's kind of a, you know, I grew up in a small town. I live in Chicago now. And in an odd way, there's actually kind of an overlap in terms of how people live in both. You know, there's kind of this tight-knit community. You walk a lot of places. And I never really realized that connection until, you know, years ago, actually reading a book that Jeff Speck and several other urban planners wrote, a book called Suburban Nation. And it just really resonated with me. And this was a long, long time ago. And I'd always kind of wanted to do a project that touched on these ideas. And then when I found out that Jeff was actually working in Hammond, I was like, well, this is the perfect opportunity to highlight these ideas in a documentary.
At one time, downtown Hammond was the epicenter of the community. And city planners like Jeff Speck share that that is the case for most communities, both urban and those small towns, as you've shared about your experience. And sadly, long gone is the heyday of Hammond, the 1950s. Presently, the area is, for lack of a better word, dead. What caused the downfall of downtown Hammond?
Well, I mean, really, you know, Hammond is like a lot of places across the country. And I think that's why it's a good, you know, a good subject for a documentary, because, you know, I think a lot of people can relate to a once thriving downtown that has been kind of, you know, slowly abandoned, really. You know, and what caused the fall of downtown Hammond, along with so many other places, is that we stopped, you know, I think we fell in love with the car so much that we started, you know, just spreading out to these bright, new, shiny shopping centers and suburbs. And we just kind of let our downtown cores, you know, deteriorate, you know, for lack of a better word. And it wasn't, and it was slow, but really it was that we just dispersed, I think is really what happened. Is, you know, Hammond and so many areas like it, you know, used to be have a certain amount of, you know, density, and that slowly over time, you know, just it lost that, and we started, you know, the wealth and all of that just kind of moved to these outer ring suburbs. I don't think I ever really realized is how important it is to have people living near our commercial districts now, you know, to make them thrive like that. You know, to be honest, that's probably what really caused the fall of downtown Hammond. In that is that Hammond was very much built as a central business district that didn't have a diverse economic base. It was, you know, shopping and offices. And people, you know, at one time, yes, they lived near downtown Hammond, but as that changed, there was really no, like, why would I go shopping in downtown Hammond and have to, you know, navigate the train tracks and that sort of thing and find a place to park when I can drive out to, you know, the shopping plaza, when I can go to, you know, Calumet City or go to River Oaks Mall and, you know, find a spot, walk inside and shop, you know. And now we're even dealing with, you know, with Amazon and online retail, you know, our relationship to retail is changing tremendously. So that's, you know, it really needs to be kind of a specialty shop or something that really connects to the community to even have a chance to survive, right?
Tom, let's talk more about your documentary. So David Mueller, the owner of Paul Henry's Art Gallery in Hammond, is a noted figure in your documentary, Walkable USA, Proof of Concept. And David talks about downtown essentially, again, being the heartbeat of the community. Talk more about why it was important for you to feature business owners like David in this film.
Well, we feature kind of three downtown business owners. David Mueller, who owns Paul Henry Art Gallery. We do Drew Fox, who is the president of 18th Street Brewing. And Raimundo Garcia, who is opening up a little nightclub called Eat right there on Holman Avenue. And we just kind of wanted to get a sense of, you know, that this isn't just a city run effort. You know, city's doing a lot. They're doing great work in Hammond, but it's also, you know, the people of Hammond, the business owners who are making an effort to really bring people back downtown. And I think they're doing it in really interesting ways. And each one, you know, David, Drew, and Raimundo each have kind of their own vision and their own way of drawing people into downtown. And they're just fabulous people, you know, and they're all doing it. You know, they could probably run their businesses easier somewhere else, but they really believe in Hammond, and that's why they're there. And I thought that was very important to get across.
Now, Tom, you said something earlier that I found quite interesting, and it's a perspective that I actually had never considered before. So earlier in our conversation, you spoke about falling in love with the car, and in the documentary, you do an
excellent job of unpacking what that looked like in terms of an exodus, if you will, to the suburbs. And you even alluded to the book Urban Nation as well earlier. But I want to ask you, what role did federal programs play into the reshaping, if you will, of city communities in a way that ushered in, again, that desire for people to move to the suburbs?
Well, certainly. I mean, after World War II, you know, we subsidized, you know, the federal government kind of subsidized this new way of living. It was bright, shiny, and new. And we kind of had this vision of, you know, the single family home, you know, you have your plot of land, and that, you know, you could hop on the expressway, drive back to the city to work, and then drive back out to the country to live. And yeah, this was completely subsidized, because I think the federal government kind of fell in love with this idea as well. And so it wasn't just a purely market-driven thing, you know, that it was kind of a, you know, a top-down reimagining of the U.S. landscape.
Tom, so one of my colleagues and myself, we always make comments to this new buzzword, future-proofing. We hear it everywhere, from education to even the steel industry. And so I want to ask you this question, as we look towards the future for the city of Hammond. What role, if any, will the Westlake Corridor play into making Hammond a walkable city?
The Westlake Corridor of the, you know, South Shoreline is integral to this kind of reimagining of Hammond as a walkable city. I mean, even Jeff Beck and David Dixon, who was another consultant on the project, you know, I think they even felt that they weren't even sure if the train wasn't coming to Hammond in the way that it is. You know, I don't think they were nearly as confident about their success. But with the Westlake Corridor, they feel that it's a very, you know, it's a very promising project. That's not to mean it's going to be overnight. And certainly, you know, the pandemic and kind of this, you know, we're currently in this era of flux of, you know, work from home. You know, what does a central business district look like? You know, the Chicago Loop is undergoing a lot of challenges. So the idea of this Westlake Corridor is a way for people to, you know, go from Hammond to their jobs in Chicago and back. That might not be the case as much as it was originally thought, but this transit is still vitally important because, as David Dixon, the consultant, phrased it, it might not be a link to economic opportunity as much, but it's now a link to experience. It's a way to connect with the rest of the region where you don't necessarily need to have a car. And that's huge for attracting, you know, younger people to an urban center.
Finally, Tom, again, your newest documentary, Walkable USA, explores how Hammond's once thriving commercial and civic center faced challenges in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. However, though, with a vision for renewal, community leaders are leveraging the expertise of City Jeff Speck, a prominent advocate of new urbanism. Speck's approach emphasizes the importance of walkability in urban design, aiming to create safer streets and revitalize neighborhoods through pedestrian-friendly initiatives. In time, in your documentary, Ann Taylor, who is the executive director of planning and development in Hammond, articulates this so well. She shares, quote, "This film captures the essence of Hammond and shows all the hard work the city is doing to make the vision of a vibrant downtown into a reality." I think you've already answered this, but I want to ask you this again as we close. Do you really and truly think walkability will become a reality for the city of Hammond?
I do believe that Hammond is going to be successful in their endeavor. I really do. I've kind of, you know, I guess I've for lack of a better term, I drank the Kool-Aid. But I think it's going to be a long time coming. This isn't going to happen overnight. There's going to be, you know, speed bumps, and they've already had some, like, you know, the reimagining of Holman Avenue has taken longer than expected. You know, the hospital has, you know, pulled out of downtown Hammond. I don't think that was necessarily expected when this project was started. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think long-term, having a place where people want to live, work, and play together, it's going to draw people in. And it's really, I think it's a blueprint that it's worked other places and it's going to work in Hammond. I truly believe it.
Tom, I'm going to let you have the final word. Do you have any final thoughts or any final words regarding the screening of your latest project, Walkability USA?
You know, I just would like to thank Lakeshore PBS and the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority for hosting the screening on April 3rd. You know, I'm just really excited to be able to, you know, show it to an audience again. I actually do have one other thing to add.
Sure.
You know, maybe that, you know, like Hammond's effort, like the reason that we, that the documentary focuses on Hammond is because we have a little bit of star power with, you know, they hired this, you know, world-renowned urban planner, Jeff Speck, and that made it a great vehicle to kind of share these concepts with a larger audience. But a lot of communities around the region are putting these concepts in place. They're putting it into action. You know, Valparaiso is really working hard to, you know, create a livable, vibrant downtown. You know, Whiting has a pretty dynamic downtown district that, you know, if you've ever been to Pierogi Fest, you know, you really see it really comes, you know, it's a great way to show that off. You know, Crown Point, you know, has a lot of development around the courthouse area. You know, and I think communities are seeing the value in creating places that stand out, that offer something, you know, different from, you know, that separate them from other communities, that make them unique. And I think a lot of places are kind of realizing that now. A challenge in Northwest Indiana is that, you know, there are so many different communities that there isn't necessarily, you know, one central city. It's not necessarily like it's Northwest Indiana is a suburb, but it isn't a suburb of Chicago. You know, it has its own pride of place and unique identity.
Great. Tom Desch is the director and producer of the new documentary, Walkable USA, Proof of Concept. Tom, again, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and we look forward to the public screening on April 3rd at 6 p.m. at the Welcome Center in Hammond.
Thank you so much.
The city of Hammond is the largest city in Lake County and the seventh largest city in Indiana. Hammond is home to more than 76,000 people. Redevelopment of the downtown area is currently underway. Admission to the screening of Walkable USA Proof of Concept is free, but registration is required. Interested attendees can register for the event, gain more information about the documentary, and access the trailer by visiting www.lakeshorepublicmedia.org/walkableusa. And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson. A recent Fidelity investment study shows a 48% increase in women customers since 2019. Unfortunately, signing up for a brokerage account does not necessarily secure your financial future, but making smart financial moves can. And while it's inspiring to see that more women are investing than ever before, they still need to plan for their financial future differently than men. To celebrate female investors making history during Women's History Month and to ensure they're making money moves to secure their financial future, Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer will discuss the reasons why women of all ages need to pay particular attention to their finances, and he will offer tips that can help women save more money for the future. Greg, as always, thank you so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me on, Dee.
Greg, so it's so exciting to hear that more women are investing. But as I mentioned in my introduction, just because a woman opens a brokerage account, that does not necessarily mean that they're securing their financial future. So I want to start our conversation by asking you, what is the first step that women should consider when starting to invest?
Well, I think first and foremost, like everyone, you need to decide on, you know, their financial goals and develop a plan that prioritizes their concerns and the things that they want to accomplish. Because if you don't have a plan, you don't really know what you need to do to reach your goal. So depending on the particular stage that they're in their life, I feel like, you know, anybody listening today, they'll have different goals, whether it be purchasing their first car or planning for retirement. And unfortunately, many people, not just the women, don't get serious about retirement saving until they are closer to retirement. And that's a huge mistake. I think it's more critical, especially for women, because statistically, they are going to live longer than men, which requires them to provide for a lot more in the future for their retirement.
Greg, I want to discuss the statistic on women's longevity in a minute. But first, to pull more from the Fidelity study, one thing I noted, it states that women have increased the number of brokerage accounts they've opened since 2019, but they still don't feel knowledgeable about how to invest and save for retirement, when they should claim their Social Security benefits, as well as how to pay for health care in retirement. Where can women get this information?
Well, since we're discussing, you know, simple things like opening a brokerage account, most brokerage firms have learning sections or investing tools on their websites. But women can also gain knowledge, just like everyone, on these topics by taking, you know, different investing or personal finance classes in the community, find out where educational events are, reading several finance books, you know, written by people they trust. You got to be careful, you know, that you're just not getting books that could, you know, be biased, but also having discussions with qualified financial professionals that focus in the area of their concerns and their needs.
I would assume a lot of people go to family and friends for financial advice before they talk to a professional or try to use other financial resources. Is that correct?
Very true, Dee. And this obviously can be a very convenient source to discuss these topics with friends and family because you're familiar with them, you trust them. And you might be able to get some good information this way, but you shouldn't get the majority of your information from friends and family unless they have a focus in the particular field that you're having concerns in or that you want to plan it. You know, while they will have your best interests at heart, they often aren't going to understand or know the entire financial picture, the situations you're in, or they might not be familiar, you know, with all the governmental rules and regulations. And, you know, just for example, Social Security has over 500 claiming options. And when you're talking about maximizing and being very efficient in your financial plan, you need to have somebody that is very familiar with these options and very familiar with the, you know, the things that could help increase the outcome of your financial future.
That sounds like advice for men and women alike. Now, I want to dig into how financial planning is different for women. So can you kind of break that down for a little bit?
Sure. Not only is financial planning different for women than men, but often women leave a lot of those financial decisions up to their husbands. You know, that's just the way that they were brought up. Many of the financial decisions their spouses make over the years will impact the wife much more than the spouse. You know, for example, you know, you have the opportunity of how you're going to elect Social Security, and spouses being the survivor, that could be very relevant, and you want to be part of that process. And of course, a lot of times when you're single, you know, women often have the opportunity to be extra aggressive in saving because they might have to rely on themselves for all of these things instead of having help with a spouse. You know, so not that, you know, the single men wouldn't have that situation as well, but men independently seem not to have the same general concerns that women would, because, you know, women are going to be more tentative to certain areas and they're going to be more concerned about, you know, what the future holds and what health issues they might need to be addressed in the future.
Greg, you know, that is really eye-opening. Now, can you give us some specific areas where women need to plan differently than men?
Yeah, and we've been talking about this a bit and referencing it. I think the biggest challenge is, you know, statistically, you know, women are going to outlive men on average by about 6 years. You know, it used to be five, so that statistic is continuing to grow. And while statistics say 6 years, the reality is, you know, women can outlive her spouse much longer, sometimes maybe 10, 15, or even 20 years. So they need to, you know, have a financial plan for that or be planning for that. Second, generally because they're living longer, they're going to have more health issues that they're going to deal with over their lifetime. And then third, you know, most of the time, the long-term care is very relevant because as you're living longer, this is a more relevant issue, right? You're likely going to be in these types of facilities. In fact, 70% of long-term care patients are women. And it's very, you know, long-term care is very costly, you know, so how are we going to address that?
Greg, that would mean that women would need to be much more aggressive in saving for retirement than men.
Yeah, generally it's a good way. But again, you know, that being said, you want to make sure that you have a plan, that the time horizons are there, and that you're not being aggressive where your appetite for risk isn't there, and then you make emotional decisions that become problematic in that process as well.
Greg, what are some proactive moves women can make to take charge of their financial house?
Well, I think the biggest thing, like if you're on an airplane, if, you know, moms need to put their air mask on first and then help the kids, right? So that they're still alert, aware, and they don't have an issue by not getting the oxygen first. And this could equate similar to funding your retirement, you know, before working on other savings goals, even the kids' education, we need to have a place for retirement, right? What is our plan? What are the things that we need to do to make sure that we're going to be able to take care of ourselves in retirement? And women need to learn about financial topics to be part of those household decisions. And the more you're part of those household decisions, generally, the better the outcome. And I think a lot more just control over what your future is. And generally, you know, women are doing the lion's share in the house. You know, they're doing everything, right, to keep the household functioning and running. And they need to know it's okay to delegate wealth management to a professional if there's just so much going on. So developing a holistic plan is one of the best ways that, you know, women and men alike can maximize their savings and be able to provide a more efficient plan.
Absolutely. And hopefully we have our female listeners on board with putting themselves first. Now, Greg, in the few minutes or so that we have left, I know we can't cover all of the steps, but what are some actionable steps that can help women save more money for their future? And I want to start with longevity, because this seems like a matter of saving more money.
Right. And once you determine your savings goal, you know, if you need more revenue to reach that amount, you can find other ways to earn money. You know, they talk a lot of times, you know, second job, a side hustle, so to speak. I mean, you see it very, very often now. It's more common than it ever used to be, regardless of the type of career. Everyone, you know, from doctors to real estate agents, we even see more female professionals creating these types of side jobs or additional income generators. But that can help really boost your savings. It could help cover expenses to provide more flexibility to, say, contribute more, you know, to your retirement plans. And if you are a married woman that is staying at home, you know, because you're helping, you know, the critical part of raising the kids, and you could still contribute to what they call a spousal IRA. And that could be done because of the income the other spouse is earning. So you can still fund a spousal IRA if you fund it by April 15th for 2023, and the contributions for the 2023 are $6,500. So you can begin to add to the savings programs that might currently exist if you are married with the spouse's plan. And if you're over 50, you have that catch-up provision, so an additional $1,000. And this can also help reduce tax burdens for 2024. You can contribute up to $7,000 and $8,000 if you're in a catch-up situation over 50. And you should seriously look at Roth IRAs given the current tax code because the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is going to expire next year. So this tax code has got some very preferential treatment that will be gone in 2026. You know, so from tax-deferred IRAs to gifting generational wealth, there could be huge changes when it comes to the tax laws once we understand what will be enacted. Now, we know it goes back to the old code, but there's likely going to be an act of Congress at some point, too, which will bring a new code. You know, so women that are newly single or widowed and used to their husband making the decisions should plan for this, because the single tax bracket is going to be significantly impacted with the change of this tax code. Also, I think, you know, just pre-retirees, retirees in general should develop tax mitigation strategies and develop a plan to unwind your nest egg in a tax-efficient manner so that you get to keep more of what it is that you spent a lifetime accumulating. And this is where evaluating things like Roth conversions could be potentially beneficial And then, you know, you should research all of your options for Social Security before making a decision. Besides, there are a few exceptions, you know, with a short window that you, once you make your decision, you can't change your selection. So it's very, very important to understand that the decision you're making fits well with the plan and the accomplishing the goals that you're trying to accomplish for your future.
Greg, those were actually some really wonderful steps regarding longevity. Now, I want to talk about healthcare. So what about healthcare?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is depending on, you know, how you're providing for your healthcare. If it's at work or if you're, you know, having a high deductible plan, look in opening, you know, an HSA. It has huge tax benefits. You can get the money in tax deduction, tax deferred, and if used for health, you know, tax free. So it's kind of a triple tax benefit and can stretch your dollars for those health care costs. And you can actually have growth oriented in it. So huge tax benefits for that type of thing. And then I think more importantly, just make sure that you have health care coverage, right? And that it is adequate and sufficient to protect yourself. I think one of the most difficult things is to have somebody save a lifetime and then have a health challenge that depletes or wipes out the money they were planning on using for retirement in an instant, right, when health changes.
Absolutely. And what about long-term care, Greg?
I think the biggest thing is look into it. There's a lot of different programs now. If it's a priority of yours or a concern, to make sure that, you know, in most cases, we don't want to be a burden to our children. Right. But it's come a long way in recent years, and just kind of understand the pros and cons of how the coverage works and, you know, kind of what the costs are and evaluate it. You know, it's not something that necessarily everybody needs to do or can afford to do, but at least satisfy your curiosity and look into it.
OK, Greg, I want to end with this question because we are speaking in regards to Women's History Month. Now, you are the father of two beautiful daughters, one of which will be heading off to college soon. So what financial advice do you give to your daughters?
Well, I the biggest thing for me is, you know, don't rely on anyone else, not to provide for you. Right. Prepare as if you need to make all the decisions. And that's how, you know, it might be moving forward. So educate yourself so you can have control, and the biggest thing, have a voice in your future. Be part of the process of the decisions that will impact you for the rest of your life.
Greg, before I let you go, you mentioned at the start of our conversation that women should look into financial classes. Does your firm, Hammer Financial Group, offer classes, seminars, or even sessions?
Yeah, and actually our website, which is just hammerfinancialgroup.com, we're typically going to have those dates posted. And I think even from a comfort level, we do a lot of them in the non-for-profit setting. So it's not a sales-type meeting. So it's a very easy way, comfortable way to come in to that type of setting, purely educational, no commitment or obligation to do anything or move forward. And those are the types of events that I think create a lot of value for folks because they feel like they can get the information and not be pressured or try to be swayed or influenced to taking action or doing anything immediately, but allow them to get some stuff that could help them, you know, make decisions moving forward.
Greg Hammer is the president and CEO of Hammer Financial Group. Greg, as always, I thank you so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me, D. I enjoy it.
Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. He's Michael Gallenberger. Joining us now on the studio line is author and former attorney, former journalist, and former Hammond City employee, Curtis Vosty, who has a new book hitting the bookshelves, Images of America, Hammond. Curtis, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Your new book, a detailed, in-depth look at the history of Hammond, really pulls out some incredible snapshots. Of course, we see the cover of a very large, significant parade. And,
that was the 1951 parade, the 100th anniversary of the settlement of the Hallmans, were the first settlers, and in 1851. And in 1951 is the cover of the book, a real nice Hallman Avenue parade gathering there.
A Hammond of old, for sure, one that sort of rekindles the the ideas, thoughts, and memories as well of a movie that we are all too familiar with from Hammond's very own Gene Shepherd, A Christmas Story. Of course, Gene makes an appearance in the book. But Curtis, you do a really terrific job of painting a picture, though no pictures available, of early Hammond and showcasing some of the old landlines and some of the old, not landlines in terms of phones, but property lines in terms of documentation and really the original origins of Hammond. And can you talk with us about that process, about what it was like doing that research and tracking down this information that, you know, I can only assume was buried in boxes for decades?
I've been here in Hammond for 40 years. I was a history major undergraduate in college, so I had a love for history. So one of the first things I did when I moved to town was to read the regional biography of Calumet Region. I rode with the police on midnights and stayed the night at the firehouse to get a good kind of feel for the city. And I've been here 40 years later, and, basically spent the last year. I was wanting to get out of my basement out of the COVID blues and decided I wanted to do the book. And surprised that they hadn't done one yet like this on Hammond. They had done a few side books on Hammond, but never the full history. And I tried to tell the history from the creation of the dunes, the Potawatomi Indians, but focusing mainly on the settlements, because these books are very picture-dominated. That's what they want.
Yeah.
There's 208, it's a very formulaic 218 pages, and I ended up having, I think, 155 photos. But I also wrote 15,000 words of Hammond's history that I studied basically for 40 years here as a journalist and author and attorney and city official. So I learned a lot over those years and put it together. You might call it a kind of a love letter to Hammond from someone who moved here 40 years ago.
And you're still there today. Yeah, the image of the book, of course, the sepia-toned image, one that I'm sure a lot of folks, if you've been anywhere near a bookstore or a book stand in the last several years, you've seen book covers similar to it. But you talk about the research process. Talk about the picture process, the 150 photos. Where do they come from? I assume they're not all part of your own personal collection, right?
Well, some of them are, but most of the photos are from the Suzanne Geist Long Local History Room of the Hammond Public Library. When I started this project, I was fortunate enough to be the president of the Hammond Historical Society and was aware of this trove of pictures, and there's just literally thousands of them from street projects, et cetera, all throughout the city. So the first step was figuring out what pictures you want to use. I knew what story I wanted to tell, and then you have to adjust the stories to the pictures. But first thing was picking out the pictures, and there's always more pictures, and some people have seen some of these pictures before in other books, but it's important, I felt, in the history of Hammond for instance, the train wreck to be seen again, and the 1918 train wreck, and
the circus
some
wreck.
Of the other pictures are some of them are familiar, but most of them are new. And then, being in Images of History series, the publishers didn't want me to spend too much time on more recent history, which we agreed would be about the last 25 years. Well, I've been here 40 years, so I had some things which they considered ancient history that I could get in the book. But some of the things are my own. And then I also went to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. And in fact, they have a great website that you could look up pictures of Hammond. Some of them were in the public domain that I could use. Some of them I had to purchase. But I felt it was important to Like, for instance, in the middle of the book, the only double truck photo is it when President Coolidge and his wife came to dedicate Wicker Park in 1927. That I went and got, interestingly enough, the website Library of Congress, that particular picture, they wouldn't let you download it. You had to go to Washington to get it, which I did because my brother lives there. And then, but then it still wasn't real good enough for the publishers, so I got a high-resolution picture there. But so that's my own picture. And there's a couple other ones, like the ones of the Hollywood script and the
for Natural Born Killers
ones. Those were just ones I had around. So anyway, but yeah, most of them are from the local history room of the Hammond Public Library. Great collection there.
We're talking with Curtis Voss, the author of Hammond from Images of America here on Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. He's Michael Gallenberger.
And one of the things that really comes up again and again in this book, and also when you just think of Hammond, is it's the city's relationship with railroads. You see that in the book multiple times. Can you talk a little bit about how, how that develops, how the city develops along the railroads?
Well, sure.
The railroads,
of course. You know, I think I have like four main heroes of Hammond. One is the railroads, one is the First Baptist Church, and Purdue Calumet. But the railroads, before 1852, the Michigan Central was the only line that came near here, and it stopped just north of where Hessville is now, called Gibson Yards. It was Daniel Gibson was the guy. But anyway, they stopped there, and then in 1852, the railroad pushed through to Chicago. And, of course, Chicago was a little town then, and it just started 1837. So, but it was growing, obviously, as an important rail center. And when that pushed through, they pushed through the railroad just south of the Grand Calumet River. The year before they pushed through, 1851, is when the Holmans first settled there. And when the railroads came, they had a boarding house to board some of the railroad workers and feed them. And then the railroads quickly grew in the late 1880s to where you had the big tie-up in downtown Hammond, where you had five different tracks coming in. And that was finally alleviated in 1995 when the Holman Avenue overpass was built. But before that, that was the worst rail intersection in the state, as well as in terms of fatalities and accidents. And then Hammond grew along the rail lines going south and east, the Erie Lackawanna. There were little settlements along there, of course, going east with the Michigan Central, and then the Monon coming from the south. And then you had the other lake along the lakefront. The Michigan Southern was along the lakefront where Robertsdale grew up, and that, of course, became part of Hammond, as did Hessville, the Saxony, and a couple other little settlements that were along railroads near Hammond. And they all, by 1923, Hammond had filled out its present size through annexation.
Curtis, to piggyback off of Michael's question, what made Hammond so unique with regards to trains? Was it just the proximity to the lake? Was it the location to Chicago? Was it all of the above? Was it something else entirely?
No, it was certainly. It was the shortest way to Chicago, which was growing as a rail center, you know, for meetings of trains coming from the south and coming from the west and the east. And that really was the key to Hammond's growth, because Hessville started when Joseph Hess, he ran a boarding house at the Gibson Yards where the Michigan Central stopped before 1852. And then when the Central pushed on and there were less reasons for people to stop at Gibson Yards, Hess moved a little farther south and started this little town of Hessville. So the railroads have been very, very important to Hammond, very, very important. And it's because of location around the lake. It was the quickest way around the lake. Although, if you've ever taken the car ferry across Lake Michigan, that originally was a rail car ferry to cut across Lake Michigan up north. But other than that, everything had to come around south of Lake Michigan and then into Chicago. And in fact, in the 1894 Pullman strike in Chicago, Hammond was a particular choke point. And Hammond for 13 days was national news because the railroads were blocked here. Strikers were pushing over rail cars, setting fires. Three people were killed in Hammond. I think 12 overall in the country from that violence, but three of them were in Hammond.
Yeah, we so often hear about Chicago and the rail car strikes versus Northwest Indiana and Hammond. Didn't know that.
Yeah, but Hammond was right there at the choke point. And in fact, the troops came down, the federal troops at Grover Cleveland, the president, dispatched, came from Missouri up to Chicago, and then they camped in Hammond between the packing house and the railroad tracks, actually three times between 1894 and 1919. Troops were sent to Hammond to control workers and gamblers, and there were four people killed in another incident in 1919, railroad car makers on strike from the Standard Steel Rail Car Company, which later on became Pullman Standard. They were on strike in 1919, and police came up and killed four of them.
And the railroads definitely are not just a major employer throughout Hammond's history, but just kind of a part of daily life as well. A few minutes ago, you mentioned the Homan Avenue overpass finally opening after years of, you know, safety concerns and disruption. And there's a great picture of here from in this book from 1995 of that opening. And we still hear that conversation today. Do we want an overpass? Do we just want to deal with the trains? Could you talk about how, like, Hammond residents kind of have learned to live with the trains and deal with them or get around them, or, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, the trains bisect Hammond in, I think, three main places. And the point is that, especially for police and fire, that proved to be quite a challenge with the ambulances. There were times before the Homan Avenue overpass where ambulance coming from north side or Robertsdale or the north side were stuck at that intersection for trains. And again, there were so many different lines that sometimes that could be really tied up for a long time. I know when I first came here and I rode with the police, one of the things I learned was that the police used to have in Hessville mostly, a patrol officer who would do nothing but write tickets to trains that were blocking intersections for more than 20 minutes. And I still think that ordinance is on the books, but I don't think they enforce it as much. But yeah, the railroads were very important, as was the packing house. And that was tied in with the railroads in the sense that the Hammond packing house that started here was one of the first to develop the use of refrigerated rail cars to transport beef to the East Coast. And so that plant here in Hammond grew up with refrigerated rail cars. And that, you know, from the packing house here in Hammond and the ones in the back of the yards in Chicago, there was meat being shipped all over the country and then shipped from there overseas to Liverpool, England. And they came from cars in Hammond, from the Hammond packing house, refrigerated rail cars. So that was a big boon for the Hammond packing house, which had about 3,000 employees by the time it burned in 1901. It burned to the ground. So that was the end of the meat packing business because they had another plant in Omaha, Nebraska that then they used and didn't reopen the Hammond plant. But again, that plant, the first major employer in Hammond, was very dependent on the railroads.
We're talking with Curtis Voss, the author of Hammond from Images of America. Curtis is a former attorney, former journalist, and former Hammond City employee. Curtis, the first line in the book is, quote, "History will no longer be written primarily by old white men." And in one of the photos is a, I think, a really interesting picture of one of the mayors from Hammond in the 1950s and 60s meeting with a table full of white men as well as a priest, which I don't think we often see in politics these days, at least in closed-door meetings with mayors. What is the story? What is the history of Hammond that you wanted to tell with the book, Images of America, Hammond?
Well, it was a town that I've moved to, and I've married and raised a family and bought a home and become my home, and I think it's a proud story. Unfortunately, when I moved here, it was not a proud time for the city. Unemployment was 17%, and plants were closing. It was an exciting time to be a journalist, but it was a sad time for the town. We see a lot of, I end the book with a chapter on resilience, and now the future beckons, because you see all around Hammond a lot of activity, and cannot but think that Hammond's got some good days ahead of it, and it certainly has good days behind it, and a lot of thought, was thought of as a progressive city in the 20s. You know, in the 50s here, the cover photo shows how popular its downtown was. Now the downtown is not the same, but the north, the marina area is now bustling with retail. South is bustling with retail. And then you have the important corridors on Indianapolis Boulevard that are bustling with retail. So Hammond changes through time. You know, I kind of wanted to document that. That opening sentence, I think it ends with that's the challenge for Hammond's youth. I hope that this book is tried to talk to some school officials. I want the kids of Hammond and the young people of Hammond know some of their history. I think it's very important to know some of your history, but the history is what you're going to write going forward. So I'm hoping this book will serve a bit of nostalgia, but also a bit of an initiative for younger people to come and enjoy history and to understand it and to realize that, it's not always the same as it is now, and you can have a part in changing your town.
This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney. He's Michael Gallenberger, joined on the studio line with Curtis Voss, the author of Hammond. Curtis, if somebody's interested in getting a copy of the paperback book, where can they track it down?
It's available at Miles Book in Hammond. It's also available on your website, your Target, your Walmart, Barnes & Noble websites, and the Arcadian Publishing Company, which is the publisher. They have a website.
Curtis, we thank you for your time and, of course, the wonderful historical lessons of Hammond. And, of course, one of those Hammond storytellers you can listen to every week here on Lakeshore Public Radio is, of course, Gene Shepherd. And he makes a brief appearance in the book as well. Curtis, thank you so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
I really appreciate it, the time, and thank you much.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. We'll be back next week with an all-new show.